This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. From May-December romance to a giant ape with a blonde he can hold in the palm of his hand, love stories on the big screen take many forms. Just in time for Valentine's Day, we're talking about unconventional love stories in the movies. Joining us are film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. Marcia's a film professor at North Carolina State University. Marcia, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Also, Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Frank.
Let's start out here. The category unconventional love stories, which seems to run the gamut. I mean, surprising when you create a category like that, you think, where are we going to go? What an amazing array of films. And one of the least conventional is featured in a brand new film called Her, where Joaquin Phoenix's character falls in love with his phone's operating system.
I even made a new friend. I have a friend. And the absurd thing is she's actually an operating system. Charles left her behind, but she's totally amazing. You know, she's so smart. She doesn't just see things in black or white. She sees this whole gray area, and she's helping me explore it, and we just bonded really quickly. I'm weird. That's weird, right? That I'm bonding with an OS. No, it's okay. It's weird.
Well, I don't think so. Actually, the woman that I've been seeing, Samantha, I didn't tell you, but she's an OS.
You're dating an OS? What is that like?
It's great, actually. I feel really close to her. Like, when I talk to her, I feel like she's with me.
Are you falling in love with her?
Does that make me freak?
No. I think anybody who falls in love is a freak. It's a crazy thing to do. It's kind of like a form of socially acceptable insanity.
That sounds so normal that it's scary.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the things that's really brilliant about this film. This is Spike Jonze. It's in theaters now. And one of the things that this film does is tackle something that could be very absurd, the idea of having any kind of a real relationship with something that is virtual, an operating system. And the film takes it seriously, and it is not as ridiculous as it sounds at first. And I think you can even tell from that conversation the way that, you know, people are acclimating themselves to this idea of having a relationship with technology that crosses certain boundaries that we currently have right now, but that are perhaps eroding. And so, you know, this film is about a lot of things. And I think this is a film we are going to look back on, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now as being very prescient about our evolving relationship to the idea of technology. But I think, you know, the film is about the pain of losing a real relationship. This is Joaquin Phoenix's character is going through a divorce and realizing that life is not going to be, you know, what he thought it was going to be, and having to think about, you know, an alternative reality. And then our increasing reliance on technology to mediate our lives. And one of the things that this film does really well is imagine a future, you know, 5 or so years from now that doesn't look that different than we look now, walking down the street, talking into our earbuds, asking our phones for help, getting places. And so one of the questions this film asks is, what other needs, you know, is that technology going to fill?
Well, one of the things that struck me about the film is, since the operating system conforms to what his needs are, that it's almost as if he's falling in love with himself, which is certainly a self-help book, you know, banner that, right, you know, this is the way that you have to travel to be in love with another person.
Well, and if we talk about unconventional love, essentially what it does not only is shine a light on these various, say, new technologies and how they're affecting us, but the very nature of love. What do we mean? We thought we had an idea, but when you hear how romantic they sound about their operating system, and yes, if it's providing for my needs, isn't that the thing we love? And what's narcissism? I mean, it really does shine a light on this whole question of what we mean by love, right?
Definitely. And one thing, various people have had reactions to the OS being played by Scarlett Johansson, who you can clearly picture through her vocal performance, which is fantastic. So does that help or hinder that you can picture exactly what she looks like? If it was a more anonymous voice, would it change the meaning of the film?
Several of our listeners told us their favorite unconventional love stories, where they come from. Some of them, I found it interesting the number of films where the main character is dead. Let's listen.
I'm Jernanya Harris-Rayner from Knightdale, North Carolina, and I absolutely loved Warm Bodies. What I love about this movie is the fact that it's like nothing I've ever seen before. It's very creative, and it will have your eyes glued to the screen to see how things turn out.
What am I doing with my life? I'm so pale. I should get out more. I should eat better. My posture is terrible. I should stand up straighter. People would respect me more if I stood up straighter. What's wrong with me? I just want to connect. Why can't I connect with people? Oh, right. It's because I'm dead. I shouldn't be so hard on myself. I mean, we're all dead. This girl's dead. That guy's dead. That guy in the corner is definitely dead. These guys look awful. I wish I could introduce myself, but I don't remember my name anymore. I mean, I think it started with an R, but that's all I have left. I can't remember my name, or my parents, or my job, although my hoodie would suggest I was unemployed.
There we go. Laura, the relationship between living and dead is prominent in the movies, right? I mean, why?
Yes, there are definitely many movies that in which somebody falls in love with usually it's a deceased partner. This is a meet-cute, dead-alive romance, which is probably a much more limited genre. But for example, in Truly Madly Deeply, it's a film in which Juliette Stevenson has lost her lover, played by Alan Rickman, to death. And she's idealizing how wonderful their relationship was. And he comes back from the dead to remind her that it was not as great as she's remembering in order for her to move beyond it.
Well, and I would point out that obviously you could tell from that clip from Warm Bodies that that's a comedy. And if you think about the other films that have used a kind of comedic idea to deal with this issue, Lars and the Real Girl comes to mind, which is a film that came out a few years back with Ryan Gosling, who's basically this awkward young man who finds companionship in a sex doll. And that sounds really ludicrous. But the film, even though it's a comedy, takes very seriously the idea of trying to find a connection to another person and how hard that is. And for someone who is awkward or insecure, that this can be a really difficult process. So what happens in that film is that there's the sense of empathy and understanding, you know, on behalf of his family and friends that evolves over the course of the film through this rather kind of ludicrous scenario. But, you know, another film that this makes me think of is Let the Right One In, which is a Swedish film. Really striking. It is a horror film on the one hand, and this is about a vampire, which is a whole other right. kind of love relationship. But in this film, it's really a kind of also a romance and a coming of age film about a young boy who's really bullied and an outsider who makes this friend, this young woman who just happens to have a huge problem, which is that she's a vampire. And it's not played in a ludicrous way. They're both isolated. They both suffer, and they find the sense of tenderness and empathy for each other. And that's played in a rather serious way.
And we were talking about falling in love with those who are deceased and the many aspects of love that this reveals. Truly Madly Deeply, Laura, is a film that you mentioned, another film about a relationship between the living and the dead. Let's listen.
Perdoname.
Forgive me.
Si tu no vives.
I know this poem. If you are not living.
Si tu, querida. Amor mio, si tu te has muerto.
If you, beloved, my love, if you have died.
Todas las noches caerán en mi pecho.
All the leaves will fall on my breast.
Lloverá sobre mi alma, noche y día.
It will rain on my soul all night, all day.
Mis pies querrán marchar hacia donde tú duermes.
My feet will want to march to where you are sleeping. Your accent's terrible.
Pero seguiré vivo.
My feet will want to march to where you are sleeping. But I shall go on living.
Do you want me to go?
No, never, 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 never.
There's a clip from Truly Madly Deeply. And again, I think, you know, certainly love and death, two of the great mysteries in the human experience, right?
Definitely. And there are many other films on the subject, including Ghost with Patrick Swayze, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, in which Jean Tierney falls in love with the ghost of a sea captain played by Rex Harrison.
Yeah. And I mean, to me, one of the great films about this very idea of romance and loss that kind of predates this significantly is Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger's A Matter of Life and Death, a British film that came out just after World War II in 1946. And it's about a flyer who his plane is going down and he radios in, and it's this American woman, British flyer, American woman on the radio. And he basically, in the last moments of his life, falls in love with her, and then through a mistake, it's a wonderful fantasy film, you know, the heaven does not get him. He ends up on Earth and meets her on Earth, and they fall in love knowing that he's got this kind of debt to pay to heaven because he slipped through the cracks. And so it's this incredible fantasy film and also a courtroom drama about as he actually appeals to heaven to try to get to stay on Earth and experience this great love in the last moments of his life. And I won't tell you what happens in the end, but it's this extraordinarily beautiful film. And it really is about this, these kind of two, the romance and also loss. And all of these films seem to have that running through it. They really, really go hand in hand. And that became very clear to me the more I thought about all of the different unconventional pairings, is that loss and love are, they go hand in hand.
Loss and love, and also memory. I mean, I think that's the other thing. How big a role, and if you get back to a film like Her, when we try to get our heads around the possibility of loving virtual, right, virtual entities, how much does memory play a part, and how real is that, our memory of a person, our memory even of you know, a loved one who we're sustaining?
Or of a fantasy of someone we're in a relationship with who we are trying to change to conform to our fantasy ideal, usually with limited success.
Yeah, and one of the things that happens in Her, I mean, Her deals with this very explicitly, A, through these kind of memories that Joaquin Phoenix has of his relationship with his soon-to-be ex-wife. And the other thing is that the operating system looks to him to create a sense of what life and experience is like. So she asks him questions as she's trying to evolve as a system, a responsive system. You know, what is it like to love? What is it like to be in the world in order to try to become more human?
Some pairings are less severe than life and death. They're just unexpected and unusual. Harold and Maude is a pretty good example.
I couldn't imagine a lovelier farewell.
Farewell?
Yes, it's my 80th birthday.
Well, you're not going anywhere, are you?
Yes, dear. I took the tablets an hour ago. I'll be gone by midnight.
What?
What a fuss this is. So unnecessary.
Don't die, Maude, for Christ's sake.
Oh, yeah. Don't upset yourself so.
I love you. I love you.
That's a clip from Harold and Maude. We're talking about unconventional romances today.
Yeah, so this is a 1971 film directed by Hal Ashby, and there's just nothing like this to my mind. I mean, first off, this is a film about first love for Harold. He's very young, and last love for Maude. And you can't really get, I think, a full sense of this from the clip. I mean, this is a black comedy, but it's also a very serious film about what it means to be a misfit, again, what it means to kind of march to the beat of a different drummer. And it was made very much in the spirit of the kind of counterculture and a sense of, I think, kind of loss and alienation having to do with Vietnam and a kind of obsession with morbidity and not being able to connect. And one of the things that Maude does for Harold is to kind of endow him with this appreciation that he can feel and emote and be different and love and live life. And that's kind of the gift that she gives him over the course of the film.
And that's certainly anything that you would want in any kind of love relationship, whether it was an unconventional one or not.
Yeah, and I think that, that even in the context of this time where there was kind of so much strife and so much a sense of a kind of senselessness and nihilism, which the film very much is kind of thinking about, that there is still this need to be loved and recognized. And that line from Maude, which I just think is a beautiful line about, you know, go and love some more, that that is this kind of at the core of our humanity. And the film just approaches it in this very dark and wonderful and strange way.
And this film is sort of the mildest version of transgression in the sense, which also shows up in these unconventional films, that this is an impermissible romance. We don't expect this kind of distance in age. And
right. Certainly if it was an 80-year-old man and an 18-year-old girl, it would be a completely different story.
Right.
Our societal expectations of what kind of an age gap is acceptable really changes based on gender.
Well, and one of the things that I like about the film is that there is, you know, one kind of intimate scene between the two of them, and it is not played in any kind of a graphic or explicit way. It's not a creepy scene by any kind of stretch of the imagination. The film really treats their relationship and their love for each other with a lot of kind of respect and dignity, given all of the indignity of the world around them.
Well, and if you think about it, and what Laura said too, the idea that morality has a way of really impinging on and impeding love. And the more we examine it through these films and other genre, the more we realize that morality is kind of a pain in the neck when it comes to finding those things about revealing yourself, opening yourself, becoming vulnerable, all the things we hope love will do when you are proscribed from same gender, from, you know, older men and younger, all those sort of things.
Right. Well, also, it was certainly an era where the mantra was don't trust anyone over 30. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Harold is bonding with someone not just of his parents' generation, who are shown to be completely, you know, powerless and uninteresting.
Shallow.
To go on to then his grandparents' generation to find that kind of validation is also interesting.
And it's so different from the handling of something like Lolita, of course, based on the brilliant Nabokov novel, and then Kubrick, where, you know, Humbert is this, you know, kind of very pathetic figure. And
he's not teaching anyone how to go on in love.
No, absolutely not. That is definitely the narcissistic, right. Selfish right. version of that.
Well, and Sunset Boulevard, I think, is maybe perhaps another example of this. Let's listen.
It was at her New Year's party that I found out how she felt about me. Maybe I'd been an idiot not to have sensed it was coming. That sad, embarrassing revelation.
Joe! You look absolutely divine. Turn around.
Please.
Come on. Perfect. Wonderful shoulders. I love that line.
It's all padding. Don't let it fool you. You know, to me, getting dressed up was always just putting on my dark blue suit.
I don't like the stud they send. I want you to have a pearl, a big luscious pearl.
Well, I'm not going to wear earrings, I can tell you that.
Cute. Come on, let's have a drink.
Shouldn't we wait for the others? It's 10:15. What time are they supposed to get here?
Who?
The other guests.
There are no other guests. We don't want to share this night with other people.
Sunset Boulevard is one of my all-time favorite movies because it's not just about a young, down-on-his-heels screenwriter who becomes essentially a gigolo for a silent movie queen living in decaying splendor in on Sunset Boulevard, but it's also about the clash between old and new Hollywood and the way that they cinematic styles can never reach any sort of a rapprochement, the way the romance is also inappropriate in Billy Wilder's fantastically sarcastic screenplay.
Yeah, so, I mean, and the relationship between that was Gloria Swanson and William Holden. It's such a pathetic, tragic relationship, and it turns into this, you know, William Holden being trapped in this web of that Gloria Swanson is spinning for him in this decaying mansion. But then there's this other relationship, which I tend to forget about until I really think about it, which is with her ex-husband, Eric von Stroheim, who's now functioning, you know, as her butler and who really loves her and is, you know, helping her live this illusion. you know, of
stage managing her entire life.
And how important is the fact that the backdrop is film? It's Hollywood. It's about spinning fantasy. It's about creating worlds for ourselves in which we even define love and what it is.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, and then of course the other relationship is that what Holden has to the screenwriter whose name I'm forgetting now, the actress who plays her, who is age appropriate for him and who is thwarted by this Norma Desmond up in the palace.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about unconventional love in the movies with film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. We will be back in a moment on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and we're talking about unconventional love in the movies today with experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. And before the break, we were talking about transgression. I think the film, the 1973 film Badlands, is a pretty good example of that. Let's listen.
One day, while taking a look at some vistas in Dad's stereopticon, it hit me that I was just this little girl, born in Texas, whose father was a sign painter, who had only just so many years to live. Sent a chill down my spine, and I thought, where would I be this very moment if Kit had never met me or killed anybody? This very moment, if my mom had never met my dad, if she'd have never died, and what's the man I'll marry going to look like? What's he doing right this minute? Is he thinking about me now by some coincidence, even though he doesn't know me? Does it show on his face?
This is one of my favorite narrational voices, in film history. That's Sissy Spacek playing the role of Holly, and Kit's played by Martin Sheen in this film. This is a Terrence Malick film from the 1970s. And, you know, the idea of an impediment to romance, you know, that is an old idea. Shakespeare, how many times do we see this kind of thing? So this is not a novel idea, but this is really taken almost to a Shakespearean extreme, which is that Kit has killed Holly's father because he doesn't want them to be together. And then it turns into this murderous spree. But there's this film alternates between the kind of gruesomeness of basically the serial killer. And this is not an uncommon theme. If you think of Bonnie and Clyde, Natural Born Killers, I mean, this is a fascination that we have with that relationship between crime and love. But then we also have these moments of Holly asking these questions about life and these whimsical scenes of them, you know, building this treehouse universe and creating this fort. And it's very childlike, and it's very, there's these endearing qualities to even basically the relationship between this, in many ways, guileless young woman and someone who's kind of psychopathic.
Mm-hmm. And the music is a very important component to this, too. Carmina Burana,
really hear that.
It makes it, it gives it a completely different otherworldly dimension. But also in all of these crime films, one of the things that's different is that the couple themselves are a perfect match and that they're alienated from society, right, but not from each other. So it is different.
Although in the case of Kit and Holly, I think that's not entirely true, because if you think about even Holly's narration right there, I mean, she's there with Kit wondering who she's going to marry. I mean, she knows that this is not going to be everlasting love, whereas I think some of the other films, and actually, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, the
gun crazy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Those.
Well, and in those films, again, as you point out, Laura, these are people who are in love in the right way over and against a social order. And we begin to quite, I mean, Romeo and Juliet was that problem, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, who gets to decide who marries and by what order? So it does raise all those questions about the impact of social order on this thing that we think we understand called love.
And it's also love and death again. It just taken to a different extreme.
Some unconventional love stories center around the escapist theme, of course, and that is these two characters over and against the whole world. Moonrise Kingdom is one of these. Well, first of all, Laura, tell us a little bit about the film.
Moonrise Kingdom is a wonderful Wes Anderson film, and of course, all of his movies are visually so precise and beautiful. He gets fantastic performances out of wonderful actors like Bill Murray and Ed Norton and just all kinds of fantastic people. And it's about a boy who is a scout who has made a plan to run away with a 12-year-old girl, and they go off on a camping adventure together to prove their love to one another.
Let's hear a clip.
Are your foster parents still mad at you for getting in trouble so much?
I don't think so. We're starting to get to know each other better. I feel we're in a real family now. Not like yours, but similar to one. I always wish I was an orphan. Most of my favorite characters are. I think your lives are more special. I love you, but you don't know what you're talking about. Love you too.
So first off, I'm really glad that that we are listening to this kind of right next to Badlands, not far from Badlands, because I hope you can hear how that sound was really influenced by Badlands. And that scene, in fact, is a version of a scene in Badlands where Kit and Holly are up in this have created this world in this treehouse. And in Moonrise Kingdom, Sam and Susie have replicated a similar kind of thing on a beach, and they're listening to music and they're dancing, and it's a scene very much emulated, I think, from that. But what I love about this film's treatment of young romance, I mean, these are this is the Romeo and Juliet, too young, they shouldn't be together, running off, is that on the one hand, it's treated in this very whimsical, comedic way with all these like hyper-stylized, beautiful, sets and costumes. But it's so touching because, once again, this is a film about people who think nobody understands me, nobody knows what I want, and they find someone who they believe does. And that's, partly defining what love is. And that's from Her, which we just, opened the show with, kind of rolling back to all of these films, that is one of the threads that's absolutely there. And it allows for the unconventional, because who's to tell you who should or should not recognize those qualities in you, and vice versa.
And it's also making your own world for love is a very important part of these things. A lot of these stories play off in very isolated environments where the lovers don't have much interaction with other characters because they're so involved in one another, which, of course, is characteristic of early stage romantic love, in which you forget that the whole world exists.
And so on the one hand, you have the outcasts, and what we have in common is the fact that we don't fit anywhere else.
Right.
And so we have – but, of course, the danger is that when you create these worlds or create your partner in the image – I have this romantic view of orphans, and this is what we often do too, right? We impose this thing on you that you will never be, and now what are we going to do? Because it started out great, but I'm never going to be that romantic vision of what you had in your head.
Right. You don't know what you're talking about. Which is something that usually when people fall in love, they don't say right away to their love object. That's something that usually comes up later down the line.
Well, I think with regard to that, if you track the ending of these films, I mean, they all end in very different ways, but most of them end with a kind of disruption. So I would say the conventional screen romance, certainly in Hollywood history, is these characters coming together and it ends in a kind of a union, typically marriage between a man and a woman.
Healing society.
Yeah, healing society, blah, blah, blah. So what these films often do is, through the course of this unconventional pairing, is they don't end with this kind of a matter of life and death is kind of an exception. I think a lot of the rest of the films that we've been talking about end in a much kind of lonelier, kind of sadder, or at least a more in a weird way realistic.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also shows that you can be in love with someone very deeply and not have it end in marriage, family, children, the things that society wants you to have.
Yeah.
How much of these films is a tribute to, or can we attribute to, Hollywood itself? In other words, to what extent did Hollywood create the happy ending to which we all aspire, and to which we rarely and it's a model we rarely meet? How much of it is playing against the backdrop of what we understand the Hollywood movie to be, do you think?
I think a lot of it. I mean, and it is an absolute fact, as far as I'm concerned, that that Hollywood imposed this sense of ending on kind of a happier high note. I mean, even for European distribution, if you look back to the kind of studio days, you know, that it was widely perceived and believed that Americans wanted happy endings. Therefore, the studio would give them what they wanted. But, well, how much is it that that's what people wanted? How much is it is that's what you've imposed on them and you've decided that's what people wanted? And in Europe, tragic endings, you know, were more common. So I do think that all of the films that we're talking today are reacting against a certain history about what a conventional screen romance is, how it should end.
I think Americans want happy endings. I think that is a pretty much undisputed fact throughout our history. We just want everything to be all right.
Yeah, well, and it shines a light on this this idea that Americans are ever optimistic, so they assume that their futures are going to be brighter than
because we're
than
not old, tired Europe given up on civilization. We're a young America that sees only hopeful outcomes.
We're looking a little down in the heel these days. Will it move on?
Allow me my fantasy, Frank.
See, you don't know what you're talking about. Sometimes, though, it's a matter of couples making the whole story is unconventional. We can go back a little bit and think about African Queen. Let's listen to this clip.
We made it. We made it.
Over on him that time, didn't we, Miss?
What a curious thing we got people shooting
at us.
Wasn't
that surprised to see the African Queen that didn't start shooting till we were past?
Our nose is dangerous in there, but it's the rate of
the didn't believe we tried to get down the gorge.
I suppose it's supposed to sound like the mosquitoes.
They didn't believe anybody could.
I felt like slapping them.
Well, we showed them. Hip, hip, hooray!
Well, what's happening here?
Uh-huh. The embrace.
Both all right?
Yes. Better than all right, miss. Well, we're running short of fuel.
Well, this is an older couple, which is another sort of very unusual couple for a Hollywood film. And they, too, have made their own world. It's a starchy missionary played by Katharine Hepburn and an alcoholic boat captain played by Humphrey Bogart, who are taking their boat, the African Queen, down a river. And it was actually filmed in Africa, so you get that feeling of isolation of just the two of them on the boat having to learn about each other and eventually falling in love. But I have to say, when I saw this as a young person, it was like, ew, older people kissing. The romance will never work out. Why did I watch this whole movie for something that clearly has such a terrible outcome? And over the years, of course, my idea about whether older people could be in love has changed significantly.
Well, I mean, the other thing that this film participates in, which is actually a very conventional thing, is that difference and bickering can end and turn into love. And
that also goes back to Shakespeare.
And that also goes back to Shakespeare. But, you know, if you think about, again, Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant and Bringing Up Baby, which is, you know, screwball comedy about, you know, these two people who are, you know, kind of not seemingly getting along in some ways and then end up, of course, together. The point being that conflict, you know, can evolve into conciliation or reconciliation. And that's...
And that hate is so close to love, yeah. Which is something that the movies tell us that I don't necessarily believe.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about how much on-screen couples fighting turns into, I mean... The scene of the passionate kiss that resolves all conflict. I mean, that is
it's Jungian.
Fantasy.
It's Jungian. They're reaching into this thing that you're disguising from yourself, and this loving woman reveals it to you.
Well, yeah.
So the most unconventional romance, of course, of all, King Kong.
Well, Denham, the airplane's got it. Oh, no. It wasn't the airplanes. It was beauty killed the beast.
Well, there are a lot of films in which somebody falls in love with someone that is characterized as a monster. And, of course, a giant ape is, you know, an excellent example of that. But I remember reading a review a long time ago of The Fly by David Cronenberg. Mm-hmm. And he said that the reason that it was such a potent romance was because in every relationship, eventually one person turns into a monster, either because you become disaffected from your partner or one person grows old and sickens and dies and becomes someone that you did not know throughout the relationship. And I have to say that quote has haunted me for the last 30 years as I watch this play out time and time again.
Yeah, well, and I think that that is a very, I mean, that's a very smart film, actually, about that very idea. And you do see that played out. And I think kind of metaphorically, whenever you create something like an ape or some, you know, someone
Edward
who happens to turn
hands.
Into. Yeah, exactly. That it's really about that idea of what is someone on the inside,
right,
and what is someone on the outside, and how do you begin to perceive people differently, you know, over time or what have you. But I think our fascination with the idea of using something like, I mean, in the case of King Kong, kind of this big beast who, you know, that final scene, I just rewatched that.
A big,
that.
Hairy man.
Yes, exactly. But that final scene, you know, where, you know, he's being shot up, you know, on the Empire State Building, and just that sense that you get of sympathy,
right,
for something that has been created that is monstrous and destructive, and that his feelings, I mean, this is that anthropomorphizing that,
right,
gets kind of evolved into what her is, allow us to feel something for him.
Well, and we see there are two very different points of view. There is the deep sympathy we feel for and really admiration for the woman or the person who can see the best in someone,
right,
that we all miss. So we admire that. The other side is our deep anxiety that there's a monster within us, and that while we would love to settle down and, you know, be good in this relationship the way we're expected to, there's a monster, you know, residing in me. And, you know, am I worthy? Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, one other way that gets played out, a film we haven't talked about, but that, you know, that I thought of in relationship to this idea of unconventional screen romances is WALL-E. WALL-E is this trash robot on post-apocalyptic Earth. We've trashed the planet. There's, you know, it's not inhabitable. And then it's about this lady robot, Eva, who is coming to look for signs of any kind of organic life on Earth. And their romance, which is so absurd on the one hand. On the other hand, it is truly,
right,
a moving, very touching film about the same kind of themes we've been talking about this whole show: isolation, feeling like you're the only person in the world, wanting a sense of recognition and companionship, and that these robots allow us to kind of think and feel that in relationship to, you know, human life.
And an awakening in that sense, an awakening of feelings he didn't even know he had, because there'd be no way to express them or feel them. Really.
Yes, absolutely. And his key into human emotion is a Hollywood film,
yep,
which is Hello, Dolly, which he watches on a VHS tape, I believe.
Over and over again.
Over and over and over again, because Hollywood is still making the markers for how we are supposed to respond emotionally.
And in a very touching scene, it's his model for how you would have a romantic interaction, because there's this scene, the scene from Hello, Dolly involves hand-holding, I believe, and WALL-E keeps trying to think about how he's going to hold, you know, Ava's hand, which is, you know, kind of like a little piece of equipment that gets shelled up into her body. And so he's got to kind of pry it out of her, you know, trying to emulate this scene in the movies.
Always a pleasure. What a great pleasure talking with both of you. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
And Laura Boies, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. Thanks, Laura.
A pleasure.
We're going to do it again next month, and we're going to talk about movies that traumatized you as a kid. Go to our website, tell us your favorite. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.